This is The New Talk, the Bob Davis Podcast, podcast 448. And in this podcast, we're going to talk about millennials. A lot of talk about young people and who they're going to vote for and how they affect the political situation and millennials in terms of the way that they work and their approach to life. And I happen to be father to a millennial child, such as it is. You are 24 years old. This is my son, Andrew Davis. He is joining us in this podcast, so you can enter and sign in if you want to. Say hello.
Hi, this is Andrew Davis. It's Bob Davis's son. I'm excited to be here for the first time on the Bob Davis podcast. I think last time we worked together was about 10 years ago when I filmed a promo, or what you meant filmed, but I recorded a promo
promo.
KSTP, or I don't know what it was. St. Louis, was it Alice in St. Louis?
Oh, maybe it was Alice
years
in St.
ago.
Louis. Yeah. So we're going to do that in this podcast.
It was actually when the last Star Wars came out.
Podcast 448. Well, hang on. Before we get started, I want to talk about yoga. You know, one of the ways that I get through the holidays is to practice yoga a lot during the holidays. And I've been really hitting it hard lately. And of course, what makes it easy and what has transformed my yoga practice is something called Hydrus. And so I love it when I get to talk about yoga and I get to talk about Hydrus because I'm talking about yoga. Hydrus is a new high-performance beverage that uses what's called exclusive nanosome technology to deliver critical electrolytes with unrivaled speed and effectiveness without the sugar in traditional sports drinks. Now, all I can do is tell you what my experience with Hydrus has been. And as I've said, and as you know, I've said it many times, it has transformed my yoga practice and my yoga experience. Because what I do is a lot of yoga in hot rooms, a lot of hot yoga, and you're sweating a lot and you're hot, whether it's Yoga Sculpt or whether it's the HOTS or, you know, power yoga. It's crowded, you sweat a lot, and you get dehydrated. And I think that by drinking a lot of water, we're hydrated. And all I do is drink water and coffee unless I'm going to yoga. And then I drink Hydrus before, during, and after my practice. And it leaves me recovering faster. It leaves me stronger. It makes a more fulfilling practice because I don't have to deal with pain and soreness because I'm getting hydrated more effectively with Hydrus. So basically, it's a hydration system and it gives me the edge I'm looking for so I can take it to the edge. For example, I do 3 sculpts a week and I think it's important because at my age, I want to build muscle as much as I can. But in addition, I want to build it in such a way that I can do other practices. And that's why we sculpt, you know, when we do yoga, because it helps us get stronger in other practices. And Hydrus helps me do that because I can do 3 sculpts a week. And at my age, you know, I think it's pretty incredible to be able to do 3 of those sculpts a week. So here's the deal. I know I can do the same for you, whether you bike, do CrossFit, SoulCycle, workout with weights, or anything that can be really physically demanding. It's been tested on world-class athletes, CrossFit, the Ohio State University wrestlers, major tennis athletes. Here's what it does. Increased work capacity, no bloating, reduces fatigue and cramping. It improves recovery, and it uses no sugar, and there are no calories. Before, during, and after, join the performance hydration revolution. Get on board with Hydrus. All you have to do is check it out at hydrusperformance.com. That's H-Y-D-R-U-S, hydrusperformance.com, or you can click on the banner, the Hydrus banner, at the top of the BobDavisPodcast.com page. A lot of people from Minnesota ordering it. Appreciate the tweets as well as any mentions on Facebook if you want. But if you want to contact me and tell me your experience, I'd love to hear it. Hydrus. And thanks you guys for sponsoring the Bob Davis Podcasts. Well, we really don't have a plan for this podcast, which is fine. But we're going to talk about Andrew and I talk on the phone a lot. He's in Los Angeles. I'm in Minnesota. We end up talking, we have these knockdown, drag out political fights. And we've been doing that for a long time. But we talk a lot about politics and we talk a lot about what's going on in the world. And I guess we should start with, you know, why we do that, because it kind of evolved from all of our conversations. So the main reason to have you on the podcast is to tell stories about me.
Okay. You just want me to tell us some stories about why we do this?
How do we start with this discussion of politics and it becomes so, it's not acrimonious. I mean, people remember the time we went to Toronto with your friend Sam? And we had a long, we had an argument. It wasn't a fight, like people would think it was a
lively
fight.
Discussion.
It was a lively discussion, and Sam was, I turned to Sam and I was like, I'm really sorry that we ended up doing that. And he goes, that was the most extraordinary conversation between a father and son I think I've ever heard, or didn't even imagine that could happen. And it wasn't, it was really actually a pretty intellectual conversation. I don't even know what we were talking about. But
well, so we've been doing this stuff for a long time. I think it started, well, it first started with bedtime stories. You would make up bedtime stories. And that was, there were all sorts of fun characters and they were fiction. And then we moved from bedtime stories into like kind of a homemade how stuff works. You know, it'd be like, I'd ask you, how does a plane work? Or how does, you know, a building work? How is a building built? And you would kind of give me the info you had. And this is kind of not pre-internet, but pre-me being on the internet. I'll put it that way. And then from there, we would get on the train, and we were riding the train a lot, and we would talk about, again, you know, how random stuff in the world worked. And then it was the news. And then for years, when we lived in different cities, we would call each other every night and talk about the news. And then at some point,
It became
politics and the news. And then I went to college for international studies and studied a lot of political science and stuff like that. And that's when we really started to get into these long hour, two hour long conversations about all sorts of crazy stuff. So we've pretty much gone through almost every issue that, you know.
Yeah, that's right. You would call me up and say, what's going on in the news? And then I would say, okay, well, here's what's going on in the news. And at the time, I think I would look at Yahoo. I would just look at the Yahoo headlines and go, well, this is going on, this is going on, this is going on, this is what's going on. I wasn't even doing talk radio then. That's when I was down in Florida. I was back and forth between Chicago and Florida and then New Orleans. And we would start talking about what was going on in the news. Do you remember that time that I was in West Palm Beach and I ordered groceries for you?
Peapod?
It was Peapod, and I had
from Jewel Osco.
This was like before, you know, internet commerce was like really new, and they had this thing in Chicago. You know, everybody knows what it is now. They have different places, but it was Chicago. It was Peapod, and I was down in Florida, and I wanted to make sure you got your saltines, and you know, I ordered.
It was really cool,
and you thought it was really cool that the groceries just came, and you thought, didn't you? You didn't realize that you could go to a grocery store and buy groceries. You thought that groceries just came up the elevator into the back of the apartment. You know, remember that? And then Mom got mad and made me stop because she didn't think that you were eating well.
I always knew groceries came from the grocery store.
She did not.
Never had that problem.
She didn't think that you were eating well because she didn't like the idea that I was getting hot dogs and saltines, because you couldn't really get farm to table stuff from Peapod at the time, because what they would do is just go to Jewel and pick out what you wanted and put it in a box and bring it over. And
we went to the grocery store long before Peapod existed. Okay. I mean, we went to when we were going to the lake and stuff. Yeah, I mean,
so you knew about grocery stores.
Yeah,
but I thought that was so great. I would go once a week and I would order.
I mean, it was really cool. And I remember you could scroll through the pictures of the food online. I thought that was really, really.
Yeah,
fascinating.
And I'd say, "What do you want?" And you'd tell me, and then I'd order it, and then it would come like the next day. It was really great.
What kind of butter? There's 17 kinds of
butter.
Yeah.
What kind of butter do you want? And that was fun. But we would get on the phone, and you're right. It started out with the news, and then lately, let's talk about what you're doing. Let's talk about your project. You're doing, and for people, you know, this is the thing about your kids, and people have told me this that know us both. Both of Andrew's parents are in media. Mom's a TV producer, and I'm doing this. And we didn't want you to be in this business because it sucks. It's a horrible business. And so he went to a university and got a political science degree and was working on Capitol Hill. And it was like, great, he's off on this, you know, government career or whatever, you know, political career. That's good. And then he quits his job on the Hill, which we're going to talk about, and goes to LA to start pitching basically a media. And I'm still fit to be tied that we've tried everything we can do to keep you out of this business. And then somebody, a friend of mine, said, well, what did you expect was going to happen when both people are in media? It looks fun. Right. When you were a kid and used to come to KSTP and watch the talk show, and we you know, Kodiak was on the air with me, and you guys would play chess while I was on the air and stuff. I mean, it looks fun, but it's a horrible business, which you're learning. But
I think it's a tough business for sure. And I think no one really knows quite what works. And then when it does work, you know, they obviously want it everywhere. So long story short, though, should I just start and tell you a little bit about what I'm doing? Yeah, so I am working on pitching. Well, that's actually not correct. I'm not pitching anymore. I'm doing.
Yeah.
So
well, that's we've had quite a lot of conversations about that, too. And that's in line with anyway, go ahead.
So I am basically working right now to launch a show on YouTube called The Millennial Project. It's about drawing out, refining, and activating a unique millennial voice in the news. And so this has been a project that's been long in the making. It all started when I was working on Capitol Hill, and I felt that there was a culture of divisiveness, of inaction, and of gridlock on the Hill. And, you know, I would go out at night, and I would meet all of these younger people scattered across D.C. and people I went to college with who had exciting ideas about how to fix our society's most pressing challenges. But what was so interesting about these ideas is that they were not just kind of pie in the sky, but that people were working on a daily basis to achieve them, to make them tangible. And beyond that, what I thought was really interesting is that people wanted to know how, you know, we could work together, so to speak, to achieve them. And so what I think was really cool is I started to believe and kind of come to the conclusion that there was a different millennial way of looking at the world. And the way I've explained it a lot in kind of different videos and write-ups I've done for the show idea is that, you know, on the Hill, there was this culture of divisiveness, of inaction, of kind of fear-mongering in politics. And what you got from a millennial side was more of a culture of, you know, excitement, of collaboration, of optimism, and this really intense drive to create tangible change. And so, you know, that's kind of the basis for this show idea, is to try to figure out, you know, if there is a unique millennial mindset and what that means for, you know, how millennials will kind of change the way that politics and international affairs works in the coming years. So it's, you know, it's an exciting project for me, and I'm really psyched to be able to, you know, get everything up and running in 2016. You know, right now we have filmed 2 episodes that should be coming out in the next few weeks, and there's a 3rd episode in the works that should be out at least at the very latest by the end of January.
Now, each of these episodes, you also have a lot of opinions about media and the failure of media to cover stories with any level of substance. And you're trying to change that. And what you're doing, I think, is tough because you're doing it in television. I mean, you're using television to cover stories with a little more substance. Explain that a little bit.
Well, I think the thing about media is that it's really hard to get your head around what media is, right? And then beyond that, it's hard to figure out what's wrong with it. And there's a lot of people that have a lot of cliche things like to say about media. And I think I should maybe start by just saying that I disagree with a lot of those. The idea that media is liberal dominated, I think, is a little bit—
We've had a lot of arguments.
Is a little bit skewed when one of the largest, you know, media companies is Fox News and Fox's parent companies, and they have a huge presence. So I think that's a misconception. I think the idea that that these things are flawed because, you know, it's infotainment, so to speak, is kind of cliche, and that's not, none of that is where I'm coming from. But if you just look at what's going on and the coverage that's being kind of pumped into my newsfeed, or, you know, or the coverage that's on CNN or Fox or MSNBC, or if you're more of a web person, you know, the Daily Beast or Huffington Post or whatever kind of portal that you use every day, I think the problem is that it's more so about the candidates and how the candidates are rising and falling in the polls, you know, rather than the issues themselves. And I think the problem with that is it induces you to think a certain way about the candidates, and it helps you pick a candidate before looking at the issues, rather than picking the issues and then looking at a candidate, which to me seems like kind of the bedrock of how, you know, you should prepare yourself for an election, is look at the issues, figure out what you think about the issues, then go find a candidate that matches those issues. And then the last kind of tiny chunk of that, in my opinion, would be, you know, making sure that the candidate is actually honest. But
what do they do? So in other words, they're not covering issues, is what you're saying.
And I hope this isn't, you know, too wordy, but I think what I'm getting at is I think they are covering issues, but they're only covering issues in name only. If that makes sense. So it's like—
Well, I don't think they're covering issues.
It's like talking about ISIS, personally. But we're really talking about how ISIS affects Donald Trump, or how Donald Trump, what he said, affects ISIS.
What these do is they take an issue like inequality or what's going on in Capitol Hill, and they break it down into all of the elements and in detail.
So there's about 10 to 15 issues that I've kind of concluded are major issues in this election cycle. And what I want to do is take each one and in something around probably 5 to 10, at most 12 minutes, do an episode that basically takes you start to finish through the issue. So you get an understanding of how it works, you know, where the major talking points are, and then you get a little bit more insight than you would in a usual article, because most of the time if you're looking at an article, if it mentions an issue online, it's going to skew right or left, or it's going to be based on some sort of outrage, or it's going to be all about how the world's ending, you know, and that's kind of problematic for me. So what I want to do is really make it about figuring out what's going on with the issue itself and come from a different angle. It's not neutral, but it's a millennial angle. And that's where we get back into that millennial mindset.
Which I'm going to ask you about.
Some collaboration and change.
I'm going to ask you about in a second, but I want you to talk about the one that we've been talking about, the inequality video, which you're working on right now.
Do you want me? I can give you a little info on the inequality and the Clinton Foundation stuff if you're looking for some kind of right resonant.
Well,
videos.
It isn't necessarily right resonant. What I think is interesting about the inequality thing is whenever you talk about inequality, you think Wall Street, because that's the storyline, that we have these people on Wall Street or Silicon Valley, where you have these people that are making enormous amounts of money or worth enormous amounts of money. And I don't even want to go into detail about, you know, a lot of times it's stock price value, you know, it varies day to day depending on the stock price. But you found an inequality story in Los Angeles that involves the Hollywood sign, which I think is really interesting. Well, if you're a parent, and I am, you know that one thing that's very, very true is that things change. And it's especially true when it comes to real estate. And it's especially true when it comes to real estate these days in the North Metro. And I'll tell you, something big changed this week. This was a week in which the Federal Reserve raised interest rates. And it was certainly expected, but it's the first time in a very, very long time. And it's going to have impact. And one of the things that's been happening in the North Metro when it comes to real estate is the market has flipped. Originally, there were more sellers than buyers. Now there are more buyers than sellers. So if you're in the market to sell, and especially if you're in the market to buy, you need a real estate professional that actually understands the market. And to help you with that, I want to introduce prideofhomes.com to listeners and subscribers to the Bob Davis podcast. Prideofhomes.com is a licensed real estate agent and a real estate investor with expertise to share with you. Here's what you do. Take a moment and reach out to Eric and Aram Lucero. They're a husband and wife real estate team with Luke Team Real Estate and prideofhomes.com. They are in the North and Northwest Metro. As you know, if you've been listening to the Bob Davis podcast, Maple Grove, Plymouth, Rogers, Dayton, Albertville, that whole North Metro 94 corridor, Elk River, Champlin. For real estate expertise, think Eric and Aram Lucero in the North Metro. 763-433-9100, 763-433-9100. Buying or selling, you got to have real estate people with knowledge of the market so you can find a property that fits your needs, or if you're selling, a buyer that can obtain the right financing and then is ready to go to close. And as a husband and wife team, Eric and Aram Lucero can respond quickly. And when you combine that with the customer service reputation at Luke Team Real Estate, you are good to go. The North Metro is growing quickly. I don't think anybody finds that a surprise with 94 and 610 expansions. They've got schools, access to both Minneapolis and St. Paul. So if you're looking to buy or sell property, contact Eric and Aram Lucero in the North and Northwest Metro. As I said, Maple Grove, Plymouth, Rogers, Dayton, Albertville, St. Michael, Elk River, Champlin, and the North Metro 94 corridor. Again, for real estate expertise, Eric and Aram Lucero, 763-433-9100, 763-433-9100, or check them out at prideofhomes.com.
So this issue I found in LA is about inequality, that's economic inequality, and the Hollywood sign. And there's been a lot written in more local papers and local blogs about this area surrounding the Hollywood sign. It's a kind of disproportionately wealthy area of people who, many of which are attempting to cut off public access to the park that allows you to get really close to the Hollywood sign. So basically, it's the best view of the sign in the city. And what you do is you go through this neighborhood, this again, this kind of disproportionately wealthy neighborhood. You climb up this trail. It takes about an hour to get to the sign. And then you don't get in front of the sign, but you get behind the sign.
Oh, cool.
And then you get a picture from behind the sign. And it's pretty awesome. And then on top of that, you can get onto this kind of peak right behind the sign that looks out over the entire city, and you can see the ocean and downtown and Hollywood and Beverly Hills and West Hollywood and all of these Silver Lake and all these, you know, kind of exciting areas that people like to talk about. And so you've gotten this issue of people kind of trying to cut off access to the sign. At least that's how it's been cast in the media in LA. And so I think, yes, it's obviously a little bit different.
People in the neighborhood are upset because of the traffic and the foot traffic, and they don't want those people coming up there. I think the thing to point out is that these are not cheap houses up there. And I mean, there are a lot of wealthy people living up there, and they don't like all the traffic. Now, you just said, we were talking about this a couple days ago, and you said, the thing is, most of those people haven't lived up there more than 10 or 15 or 20 years, so it's not like this is anything new. I mean, this whole started, the other thing that I think the really important thing to point out is, nobody really knew how to get up there until Google came along with Google Maps, and you can Google it and find out how to get up there because you can get directions.
Well, right, and the thing is, I mean, what's really amazing is that these people actually have gotten Google using the city council, the power of the city council, and their own kind of prowess with Google itself. They've gotten Google to move the map pin from the actual Hollywood sign to a park that's like 5 or 6 miles away from the sign. And so, I mean, technically the sign is in this park. It's called Griffith Park, but it's, you know, this is a huge, it's the largest urban park in the United States, and the sign's at one far end, and the observatory that they send everyone to is at another end. So,
oh, that's where that is. The famous Griffith Park Observatory is at the other end, but that's kind of where the Hollywood sign is. Oh,
so it's an interesting issue, and I don't think it's interesting just because it's in a place that you don't normally associate with inequality, but I think what's really fascinating about it is that it's a local politics issue. So there's a lot of talk when it comes to inequality about taxes and numbers, and there's certain groups that people are kind of, you know, it's whether it's the wealthy's fault or it's, you know, whatever, it's this or it's that.
But numbers like the Gini coefficient that you have to...
Yeah, I mean, I don't... Listen, I'm not... I am an advocate of fixing what I see as a problem, which is economic inequality. So I think economic inequality is a problem in the United States. And I think it's a problem in New York as well as in Los Angeles. So this is not, you know, this is not an issue that I'm going after, you know, in order to somehow paint people who are Bernie supporters as, you know, people who don't care about inequality. That's not what I want to do here. What I think is really interesting, though, about the issue. Well, obviously, I think that's coming through.
No, I think the thing that's interesting is that I'm not saying that I'm not putting words in your
mouth. No, I know, that's why.
But I think the thing that's interesting, the takeaway that I have, and I haven't seen the footage, is when you think of inequality, you think of Jamie Dimon, you know, and you think of Mark Zuckerberg, and you think of these wealthy, you know, captains of industry who are worth enormous sums of money, and then there's these homeless people. But they always show pictures of people in New York City. You don't see Los Angeles, which is probably more unequal show business. I mean, some of these people are making enormous sums of money, and they're people that you and I we don't even know who they are, and they work in the film industry, and they or in some ancillary part of the film industry, finance or something, and they make huge amounts of money, and you know, it's probably, I'm willing to bet that the inequality, that the Gini coefficient of Los Angeles is probably far worse than New York City.
I mean, you can just look that up, and you'll have a hard number. Yeah. So we can, I mean, that's, I don't want to comment on that, but
I'm just saying I'm willing to bet that. That's all.
Well, you don't have to bet. You can just look it up. But what I will say is, and this is what makes the, but what really makes the issue interesting, and this is what I was working to get at before, is that it's a local politics issue. So that there's no way to fix the problem without creating a cost or a benefit for a specific group of people within the community. And so instead of having this very amorphous issue of economic inequality that we look at on a national level, and it seems easy to simply say, well, we'll tax a little bit more here, or, you know, we'll cut a little bit there and we'll put some money towards this other place. You know, when you look at it on a local level, every single idea has major costs and major benefits, and you have to try to mediate that. And so it really changes the way you look at inequality, because it's not a simple fix anymore. And so what I think is really fascinating about this is you have this, you know, national landmark. You have it's a symbol that everybody knows, and it's a symbol that's kind of in a weird way under assault by a small group of people within this disproportionately wealthy community. And that's where I think, if that makes any sense, that's where I think, you know, the kind of the kernel of the issue lies. But the other thing I do have to say about this neighborhood is, what also makes it interesting is it's not that wealthy of a neighborhood. It's not Bel Air, it's not Santa Monica, it's not Beverly Hills. It's the Hollywood Hills. And a less wealthy subset of the Hollywood Hills within even that.
Yeah, but I mean, by Minneapolis or even Chicago standards, these people are not, they're not pikers.
No, I mean they're definitely wealthy, but they're not $5 million homes.
Or that gigantic thing that we saw when we were driving around through Bel Air that ended up in the New York Times.
Right.
That dude's house it looks like one of Saddam's palaces is what it looks like.
It does. But this is not, but that's not the area we're looking at.
No, Bel Air is way away from the Hollywood sign.
So this area, the houses are roughly $1 to $2 million, and up this street called Beechwood Canyon, and that's the street, that's the neighborhood, that's the neighborhood, Beechwood Canyon neighborhood is, was what, you know, they're the people who are kind of lobbying the city to shut off access to the sign. And their position is that there's a lot of tourist traffic that was not here before Google Maps, and it creates fire hazards, and there's people who are tourists who don't understand how dry LA is, and they go up and they smoke, they throw a cigarette butt into the bushes, it could create a fire. And, you know, these are actually really valid issues, and this is where, again, this is where the larger episode gets so fascinating, because there's so much more, you know, the deeper you get into it, you know, the more you find out, and like the crazier, you know, you just get further and further into the rabbit hole, so to speak, and it gets more complicated. So I don't know if that makes sense, but that's what's drawing me in.
You met some really cool people too. And there's people on the other side of that that don't agree with that, right?
Well, the thing is the neighborhood itself is very splintered. So you have certain people who are extremely vocal, who are lobbying the city to get this access shut off. And then you have people at the same time who are, you know, who are huge public space advocates, who are Bernie supporters, let's say, who are very much against this idea of cutting off access because they moved to the neighborhood so that they could hike the Hollywood sign every day. You know, so it's like, it's really this, like, this crazy thing. So that's just within the actual neighborhood itself. And then you pull out a little bit and you get public space advocates from, you know, other kind of like hipstery areas in Los Angeles.
It's a NIMBY issue. We call those.
It's really
not
a NIMBY issue, though.
You don't think it's a NIMBY issue?
I think it's somewhat. I mean, it's just, it's hard to pin it down, and that's why it's such an interesting topic. Okay, sorry, I'm not trying to.
No, it's fine.
But I'm only saying that because people I've interviewed have been very adamant that they don't feel it's a NIMBY issue, and so that's why I kind of stopped you, because I don't know. I'm still searching for an answer to that.
But this is an example of what you're saying is these things that end up as lurid headlines or clickbait on Breitbart or whatever, or for that matter, Huffington Post. Are usually pretty complex issues, and we never understand or hear the complexity.
Well,
and so what you're trying to tackle is you're trying to take those kinds of complex issues and give them a 5 or 6 minute treatment on television. I don't know how you do it, but I mean, I honestly don't know how you're going to do it, but you're trying it. And then there's going to be a YouTube channel, a Millennial Project YouTube channel that will hold the videos, and you're going to be programming your own channel. So let's talk real quick about, so is there a millennial, definable millennial political perspective?
There's definitely polling data that can give you an idea of where millennials stand on a variety of issues. And so in general, millennials are center left, with a special kind of skew leftward on any social issues. So like gender, race, you know, sexuality. That they're going to skew further left. And then when it comes to, you know, but when it comes to some
economic
other issues, you know, they may also
skew, you know, pretty conservative.
They're less left leaning as
economic
a whole,
issues.
Not on abortion and gun control. So there's a lot of left leaning, but they're not quite as far left. So there's more millennials who skew right, if that makes sense, on the gun control and abortion stuff. So that's like kind of a weird little way to say it, but more broadly, you know, millennials lean or identify 51% Democrat and 35% Republican, which it makes
with a lot in the middle. I mean, 51% and 35% leaves a lot in the middle.
Right, but that makes us the most liberal generation in America today. More liberal than X, Gen X, more liberal than baby boomers, more liberal than, you know.
And I think you're liberal, and you go and hang out with your friends and they think you're a crazy Reagan Republican.
Well, I don't think they know what to do with me. And that's kind of the problem is it's like I've been all over the spectrum and I think I've done a lot of work to try to understand where thoughts come on both sides. And I have a tendency to discuss with people from the devil's advocate side. So if I'm with people who are conservatives, I'll skew more liberal if we're talking about politics. And I'm with people who are liberals, I'll skew more conservative. And that's the goal of that is to try to, you know, eventually find some sort of a workable common ground. Because if the ideas on either side are valid, they should cross beyond this kind of like really weird spectrum in American politics that we've constructed that doesn't exist in a lot of other places. You know, we've decided that for some reason, if you're religious, you should also be small government, but that doesn't necessarily make sense. And, you know, we've also decided that if you're a minority, you should presumably statistically skew more left, which also doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense. You know, so this is just like, I think, and when it comes down to the way the issues are tied together, you know, why is it that small government people would also be against, you know, gay marriage? That doesn't make any sense. Why is it that, you know, if you are for, you know, expanding the franchise and making sure that, you know, everyone has a chance to vote and be part of our internet or part of our democratic system, why is it that you would be so open to the idea of expanding the size and scope of government when, you know, there are clearly dangers to doing that. So I think that there's a lot of contradictions within our spectrum of politics, and what they've done is taken a very wide body of complex issues, a very wide kind of like three-dimensional, you know, set of issues, and just slammed them down into this really overly simplistic right-left political spectrum. And that's what I'm trying to do, is break through that kind of stale thought and give people, whether they are on the right
it's
or the left.
It's a crust. It's a stale thought crust.
It's a stale thought crust, well, yeah.
But I mean, what's it like to be a millennial? I mean, and see all this. I mean, is there, from inside the generation, do you feel that different from your dad? You know, I'm pretty weird, but I mean, you know, do you feel that? I feel like there's actually more kinship between my generation and your generation than was with my dad and my generation when I was growing up. I mean, we just didn't really talk about stuff because you'd end up in a fight, and we don't seem to have that problem. We have discussions, you know, but it seems like there's a little more kinship, at least in this family, with the younger generation. I mean, I'm always hanging out with you guys. We have a bunch of, you know, grandchildren and children in the family, and I'm the crazy uncle that hangs out with you guys, you know, and I'm your dad, obviously, but... Do you feel that different? Do you feel that you look at things that differently?
No, I don't think that we look at things any differently than any other generation has.
Even with the cell phones? Because that's the biggest complaint.
Well, let me restate.
My generation's biggest complaint is, these kids and their cell phones, and it's like they think of it as an appendage. They don't think of it as something that they are even aware of. It's just part of their life because it's been part of their life.
Yeah, I mean, I
since 9/11, honey, we're going to give you a cell phone in case something happens, and you can call us, and we'll come and get you in the station wagon.
No, I think we're kind of both doing what generations do, right? Like, we're young and we have all this crazy stuff that we do, and we're like all about this, you know, our social media and our cell phones, and we don't see why that's a problem. And people who are older are like, I can't believe these kids don't know how to focus, and they don't know what they're doing, and they've never, you know, had a real conversation. And it's like those types of critiques will be being lobbed back and forth for the next, you know, century. I mean, I don't know. It's just every, you know, everybody's got.
Wait till you have kids, and then you'll understand.
But I think we do have. I think there is a unique set of common coming-of-age political experiences, just like our generation had Pokemon, The Lion King, you know, and Sesame Street. You know, we also have specific coming-of-age political experiences. We have the war in Iraq. We have the 2008 financial crisis.
Oh,
we have
the advent of the internet.
And, you know, obviously 9/11, which spurred the war in Iraq.
I'll give you an example. When Kennedy was shot, I distinctly remember them taking us into the rec room, which is what they called it, which was a little gym, and sitting us down, plopping us down in front of a they used to have this weird projector thing that projected the TV onto a bigger screen. And it was really, I mean, this is a long time ago. And we sat there and watched the coverage of Kennedy. And you guys, they didn't even tell you going on.
That was my school. My school was weird. They didn't know what to do with the issue. So they basically put notes on our back. They pinned notes to our back. You know, I was pretty young. And they sent us home. And they kind of let the parents deal with it, send us home. I don't know if we went home early or later, how it worked that day. But to make a long story short, I do remember very clearly that's the first big anything you could call akin to a political memory that I have is 9/11 and sitting in my classroom the next day and learning about who Osama bin Laden was. And that really fundamentally changes the way that we look at the world versus other generations. And on top of that, you know, what I think almost everyone would agree is, you know, a very checkered history of our involvement in the war in Iraq, these types of experiences have defined differently, have imprinted our blank political minds differently than other generations, and we're going to therefore govern differently than baby boomers or Gen Xers or greatest generation people. And so that's, you know, that's something that I want to get into. It doesn't mean that, you know, Reagan ideas aren't valid. It doesn't mean that, you know, no one knows who JFK is or anything like that, but it means that we're going to do things differently, and I want to know how that's going to play out.
And you're not saying you know how. You're not saying it's going to be different. I don't know how different, but that's what you want to find out through the Millennial Project.
Exactly.
Sort of discover that.
I want to discover that, and I want to facilitate that, because I think, you know, there's a lot of news websites and a lot of people out there who are trying to market news content to millennials. And what they seem to be doing is taking polling data or taking market research and saying, well, we know millennials like legalization of marijuana. We know that they're really gung-ho about, you know, like being outraged about, you know, about gender issues and racial issues and stuff like that. And so what we're going to do is we're going to
talk about those issues.
We're just going to basically create content that supports those ideas. You know, and the other thing about millennials is we also have kind of contradictory political beliefs in a lot of ways. So like we, as far as I understand from some of the stuff I've seen, you know, we want smaller government, but we also want the government to do more for people.
What was it like to work in the Capitol? Where do you get off with this? It's a sick atmosphere and they don't accomplish anything. And, you know, that just rolled off your tongue like, you know, like butter.
What was going on is that it became clear very quickly that that institution was not geared to address challenges the way that we expect them to address challenges. And I think the general idea from the American people is that we elect these guys, we put them in a room, they look at all the issues and then they hash it all out and then they sign a bunch of papers and then they're fixed. The problem is that's not really how democracy is intended to work. And what you're really supposed to do is we are supposed to discuss the issues. We are supposed to debate with each other, to do the work, and then we're supposed to tell our congressmen, we want, you know, you to vote this way on this issue because this is how we know it should be fixed. And then they go do that, or they don't go do that, and then we vote accordingly. To expect them to do it and to is a little bit off the mark.
And it's called the Millennial Project, and the channel's not up yet, but it's supposed to be up soon because you have to go home and edit at this point, right?
Exactly. We're right. Excited. Do you want me to talk
thank
about
you, more? Andrew Davis from the Millennial Project.
Thank you for having me, Mr. Davis.
The Bob Davis Podcast. A lot of people moving up to the North Metro these days. Schools, the 610 expansion, 94, and the market up there is changing. So if you are looking to buy or sell, you need real estate professionals with knowledge of the market, and that's where the husband and wife team, Eric and Aaron Lucero, comes in because they can respond quickly to your request. So reach out to those guys if you are looking for property or looking to sell property up in the North Metro. 763-433-9100. That's 763-433-9100. Thanks to Eric and Aaron Lucero for sponsoring the Bob Davis Podcasts. And of course, you know, all through these holidays, probably, hopefully, if I can find a studio open on Christmas, I'll be doing yoga on Christmas Day as well. It helps keep the stress down. And the reason I can practice every day is Hydrus. And it will work for you if you do Orange Theory, if you do Soul Cycle, if you work out with weights, if you do anything that is physically demanding. You may not be hydrated, even if you drink water. That's the whole thing about Hydrus. It's a great way to get your muscles hydrated. So here's what you do. You go to HydrusPerformance.com, HYDRUS, HydrusPerformance.com. You can get a free sample. You can find out about the product. I highly recommend it. For sure, it's been working for me. It's Hydrus, HydrusPerformance.com, or you can click on the banner at the top of the BobDavisPodcast.com. And thanks, you guys at Hydrus, for sponsoring the Bob Davis Podcast. Send me some more stuff. I need some more Hydrus. Now, if you're a pilot, you want to be safe on takeoffs and landings. I don't think there's any debate about that. And you really, if you want to be safe on takeoffs and landings, you might want to take a close look at Alpha Systems because Alpha makes the revolutionary angle of attack indicator. Bottom line is Alpha Systems AOA saves lives. It's FAA approved. They want to get it into your avionics package today. It's economical to do it. Click on the Alpha Systems banners for more information about Alpha's revolutionary angle of attack indicator at the Bob Davis Podcasts.com. All right, guys, thanks for listening on iTunes and TuneIn or Stitcher.com or BlogTalkRadio.com or the new live radio show at GCNLive.com. Keep listening for information about that. Thank you for liking and sharing and favoriting and following on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. I'm BDavis7843. I haven't used Periscope yet, but I'm going to do some Periscope stuff when I head down to Iowa to cover the 2016 caucus. We're leaving towards the end of the last week in January, going to do some events down there, and I really appreciate the donations for the Bob Davis Podcast's Mobile Command Center, which I take the money in for donations, goes directly into the diesel fuel fund, and I'll tell you more about that as we get closer to caucus time. Thank you for listening to Podcast 448, and thanks, Andrew, for joining us. Bye-bye. I'll leave you with some outtakes.
Excuse me, it's also invalid. If you have a set of ideas, I don't know what I'm trying to say. Did I get it?
Say it. It's See, also, making me edit.
Well, I'm sorry. It fell out of my head.
Say it.
So, no, just keep...
So hurry up, because we're at 34 minutes right now.
We can cut out a bunch of good stuff. Check, don't worry. One, two, three. Check, one, two, three. Testing, one, 1, 2, 3. Am I being recorded? I can see my little things.
Yeah, we don't want to go. We don't want it to be too hot. But see where I'm about right here. So where you want to be is you want to have this about an inch away.
Is this too hot?
This is the new talk, the Bob Davis podcasts in podcast 448.
Why are you doing that?
I can hear that.
Sorry, just doing a little.
Have you ever had a dream that